We are talking today with Thomas Lindsay and Mari Margill. Thomas Lindsay is executive director and co-founder, and Mari Margill is associate director, both with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, also known as CELDEF. Tom and Mari, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us on your show.
Good to be here, Mike.
So start out, tell us a bit about CELDEF.
Sure. The best place to start is probably back in 1995 when the Legal Defense Fund was created. And we were created to do something that sounded very simple at the time, which was to provide free legal services to community organizations and to rural, local, municipal governments. And the primary reason for that was simply cost, in that today and back then, it's an exorbitantly expensive to retain an attorney if you're a community organization that doesn't usually have two dimes to rub together. And so you're looking at $200 to $600 an hour for an attorney to do something for you, whether it's look over an ordinance or appeal a permit or do that kind of work. And we decided to create the Legal Defense Fund so that people would have access to legal services, not just for the things like public defenders do in the area of criminal law, but actually to provide free legal services to groups that were fighting things like toxic waste incinerators or landfills or Walmarts or factory farms or other things coming into their community that the communities didn't particularly want. And so for a number of years, we did that traditional conventional environmental work, which was representing about 300 different community organizations in Pennsylvania to appeal permits that had been issued from the state to primarily corporations to put in certain projects in their communities. And while we did that for a number of years, eventually it got to be very exhausting for us. We reached a crisis moment. And the crisis moment was that we would win these appeals in court. We had quite a win-loss record, and, you know, we got invited to the White House one year, and we got the funding and the accolades and all that kind of stuff because we had this tremendous win-loss record. But eventually the corporations would simply come back and refile their permit applications over and over and over and over again. And eventually, even though we had this win-loss record, if you walked into the communities where we were actually assisting these organizations, you would find very little parallel between what was happening on the ground, which was 99% of the time these facilities would site in those communities versus this win-loss record that we had on paper. And so we decided at that point that we needed to do something different because our job really wasn't or shouldn't have been about helping corporations prepare better permit applications, which in essence is what we found ourselves doing at that point in time.
All right. So what did you come up with for doing better?
Well, we had several communities come to us, and they said, well, instead of regulating these facilities, which under the structure of law, generally communities are relegated to simply regulating certain operations when they come in. And, you know, looking up the word regulation in Webster's Dictionary, what you find is the definition is to adjust the rate and flow. It has nothing to do with actually saying no to something coming into the community. It has to do with attempting to get the corporation to minimize the harm that it's going to cause once it's there. But regulating, the verb, means dealing with it once it's there. And our problem with that is that in essence systematically divests communities of decision-making authority to decide what their communities are going to look like 20, 40, or 60 years in the future. If you can't say no to a Walmart coming into the community, you can't say yes to a viable downtown. Doesn't work that way. You have to have the power to say no. And so under the system of law, unfortunately, that saying no has been taken away. And it always sounds strange to say it in democracy schools. Sometimes it's the first aha moment, these two-day trainings that we run, is that under the structure of law that we have, if there's a permitted use by the state or federal government, a legal use, and Walmarts are legal, factory farms are legal, land application of sludge, legal, toxic waste incinerators, legal, landfills, legal, all the, a lot of the bad stuff that we think about is all legal, like fracking, this recent invention to get at natural gas that's hitting a lot of states now, and all the tremendous damage that it does to water supplies. It's still legal. It's a permitted activity under the law. That under our structure of law, if you have a permitted or legal activity that's been permitted by the state or federal government, the community itself is prohibited from banning the legal use. And to a lot of people, that always sounds like, wow, that doesn't sound right. There's something wrong there. That just because the state or federal government, which generally are controlled by the same corporations writing the regulatory and permitting schemes, just because the state or federal government says, we're going to give you a permit for that, why should communities have to bear the onus or bear the brunt of that activity that's coming in when the community didn't assent to it? And so in some ways we came to the conclusion that it's not necessarily a sludge problem or a toxic waste incinerator problem or a factory farm problem. It's a democracy problem, that communities have been divested of this power to say no or to say yes to the futures that they want, and that those that power has been very carefully divested from them or stripped from them over the past 140 years. And so the democracy schools and the work that we started to do was actually to enable and assist communities to say no. That's where it started. It was that simple. And to actually frontally challenge the legal doctrines that have somehow stripped this authority away from communities. And I guess on that point is the fact that a lot of people think that we have democracy in this country. They, you know, you ask most people and they've had the IV drip in their arm since kindergarten, which is founding fathers are the best folks that ever trod the planet, most intelligent folks that ever trod the planet. You ask most people, they think the United States is the only place that has a constitution in the world. But when people run up, you know, who are living in these communities, they actually run up against the structure of law. They find out very quickly that we don't have democracy operating in this country, at least over the real stuff. I mean, we can pass noxious weed ordinances and get rid of plastic bags and do those types of decisions, which we need to make, of course, in these communities. But when you actually assert real decision-making authority over whether a Walmart should come into a community, or make decisions about what sustainable farming should look like in a community, or what sustainable energy should look like in a community, you run up against a structure of law that says, no, 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 you as a community, you silly people, you don't have the authority to make those decisions. This system of law has given that authority to a small board of directors, sometimes located 3,000 miles away from the community in which that activity is being pursued. And in many ways, the corporations which have been given these rights over the past 140 years, in essence, the structure recognizes that a small minority of corporate decision makers have more rights than the people who live in the communities where that activity is being pursued. And so our work over the past 13 years has been to right that balance, to in essence, bring community decision making to a point where it actually is the default. It's the legal default that ordinances, local laws passed by communities, are actually turning the tide and turning it upside down so that corporations aren't the ones that have rights that are superior to the community, but the community has rights that are superior to the corporation. And like I said, 140 years of concocted case law over the past 140 years to keep us in a carefully circumscribed box of activism. But our work over the past 13 years has been about vindicating that community self-governance so that corporations and a minority of corporate decision makers don't make decisions that trump community majorities in these communities who want to build sustainable futures.
So, and the way that you've worked with these communities is through democracy schools. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It's an interesting moment that happens for a community when they come up some sort of corporate assault or corporate threat. And Thomas mentioned Walmart or factory farms or incinerators. In New England, we've worked with a number of communities that are facing these corporate water companies like Nestle and USA Springs, sometimes known as like Poland Springs, which is one of Nestle's brands. And a community runs into a very interesting moment when it turns to, when it finds out that a corporation wants to come in and withdraw, you know, any number of hundreds of thousands of gallons of water a day from their local aquifer, often the very first call that they'll make is to call up their state environmental regulatory agency. So, for example, in New Hampshire, where we've done quite a bit of work, there's the Department of Environmental Services. The community will call them up and say, listen, we want to protect our water from Nestle coming in and taking our water, which the impacts of that kind of water withdrawal can be massive. It can lower lake levels. It can reduce river and stream flow. It can address habitat. It can impact species that rely, those aquatic species that rely on those habitats. And so communities have very good reasons for not wanting a Nestle or other corporation to come in and take their water. They call up their state environmental agency. Here in Washington State, it's the Department of Natural Resources. There's also the Ecology Department. And that state agency will say to them, no, you can't stop this water withdrawal from coming in. You can try to appeal the permit if you want to. But what happens is that the community finds out that not only is the state not there to help them protect their water, the state is actually sitting there handing out permits to Nestle and other corporations to take it. And that's often the time when a community will contact us and say, this sounds wrong to us. We can't seem to make a decision to protect our water. It seems the corporation in the with the state is making that decision for us. And very often a community will host a democracy school, which we're holding this weekend here in Seattle, in which we've held over 200 across the country, in which we examine how does this structure of law work, this regulatory structure that Thomas was talking about. How is it that we've ended up in a place where our communities, where people, where workers, where nature all seem to be at the short end of the stick, seem subordinate to corporations as facilitated by our state and federal government. And we examine that, we explore it, we look back 1,000 years in history to see how did we end up with this structure of law based on English common law such that we are disempowered by our government instead of empowered by our government. And once communities go through that kind of conversation with us, it's an examination of how we sit in this world. They often decide to take a step, which is we understand that in order to stop Nestle from coming in and taking our water, it's not enough for us to block the permit that the corporation is going to the state to get. We actually have to completely change the paradigm in which these kinds of decisions get made. Thomas said, you know, it's a question of democracy in these communities. These communities are saying, well, who should be deciding these kinds of very critical questions about our environment, our public health, our local economy, and so on? And working with us, they're turning that paradigm upside down such that we work with them, and we've worked with it well over 100 communities now across the country, to adopt laws which seize local governing authorities such that they can determine what their community looks like. Not only are they saying no to Nestle or Walmart or other kinds of corporate assaults from coming in, they're also saying yes, yes to sustainability so that we want to have sustainable access to water, yes to nature actually having rights in our community. We call it rights of nature, such that nature is able to actually defend itself, or people on behalf of nature to defend the ability of ecosystems to survive and thrive, aquifers, rivers, and so on. And so these communities are actually saying no to a threat, and then more and more they're now saying yes, we want our community to look like this, and we're actually putting in place laws working with our organization that establish what that's going to look like in their community.
So you've actually had successes on this.
Yeah, we've worked with communities beginning in Pennsylvania, as Thomas mentioned, moving to New England. We've worked with communities in Virginia. We're, in fact, now working in Spokane, Washington. We're talking with folks up in Bellingham, having a democracy school here in Seattle, to bring what we call this sort of rights-based activism, such that people, communities, nature, asserting their rights in their communities to make the kinds of key decisions they need to over and above the interests of property and commerce, or in a nutshell, corporations. And so we've had about 120 communities across the country adopt these kinds of ordinances, and more these ordinances are moving from not only saying no to bad things coming into our communities, but saying yes to establishing those kinds of legal frameworks that we need in order to develop the sustainable places that we want to live.
I think a lot of us who have worked on these issues before run into the problem of federal laws trumping local laws. How do you deal with that?
Well, there are basically four legal doctrines that keep communities subordinate to a certain structure of law. One of those is something called corporate rights, which corporations have constitutional rights in the United States today. It's taken 140 years to get to this place, but corporations have the same rights as you or I. They have the same rights as persons, which means that corporations have First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, 14th Amendment rights, basically constitutional rights that were originally accorded only to natural persons that corporations now claim.
Just to jump in, I think a lot of folks are familiar with the Citizens United decision from about a year ago now, which the U.S. Supreme Court determined that corporations, in fact, can make direct contributions to federal candidate campaigns, which they were barred from doing before with the idea that we want to prevent corporations from having too much undue influence on elections. I think a lot of people were really rather surprised by the Citizens United decision, which wiped all of that law away such that corporations can now give untold millions. They were able to do it in a roundabout way before. But in any case, that was just a reaffirmation that corporations have these rights that you and I have, natural people have. Corporations have had them, you know, it's been almost 200 years of jurisprudence now in which corporations have been found to have these kinds of constitutional rights. And I think that Citizens United kind of woke up a lot of folks to this idea. And it's not anything new, it's just that it was a very publicized case. And I think in some ways Citizens United serve to kind of lift that veil that corporations have those kinds of rights.
Yeah, it left us shaking our head for a little while because we thought a lot of folks, especially progressive liberal groups, were being slightly naive about Citizens United because First Amendment rights for corporations have been around for at least 60 years. And, you know, so you've had cases over the past, a case called Bellotti in Massachusetts, which knocked down a prohibition on corporations spending money on referenda. You had a case in Grout of Vermont where the Vermont legislature tried to make grocery retailers and milk producers and milk retailers put labels on those products that contain artificial bovine growth hormone, this hormone that they shoot into cows. And the Grocery Manufacturers Association brought suit against the state of Vermont and got it overturned on the basis of the free speech rights of the Grocery Retailers Association. So as Mari was saying, Citizens United, really nothing new. But when it comes in and it crashes down 100 years of federal law on campaign finance or campaign finance spending, that you get into a place where a lot of people start to pay more attention to it, which I think is what happened with the corporate rights stuff.
I think what the case really served to do, Citizens United, was move this idea of corporate rights from something sort of amorphous into something very practical about how it affects us in our day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's useful in the sense that it helps people to get a better handle on what this corporate rights idea is.
It's also not just corporate personhood. It's commerce clause rights and contracts clause rights that the Constitution gives to certain entities. And so when we talk about corporate rights, that's one piece of the puzzle. In essence, if a community attempts to ban a factory farm or ban a big box store, any big box stores from coming into the community, at that point you open yourself up to a lawsuit. And the lawsuit usually comes in from one of the big box store corporations contending that the municipality has violated the corporation's constitutional rights, specifically that the ordinance is a takings of their property under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments as persons. Kind of stuff happens all the time across the United States. You know, every week, every month, there's a new decision based on corporate rights. It's just an unquestioned thing in the system. So corporate rights is one piece of the puzzle. The second piece of the puzzle is something called preemption, which is where the federal government steps in and attempts to preempt the states and localities from passing legislation. Also, state legislatures do preemption. They pass preemption laws which preempt the local. What's fascinating to me is that those preemption laws, and they don't start out as preemption laws, they start out as like food safety laws, which is one of the most recent examples. And then the agribusiness corporations were able to insert a preemption clause in it, which says to the state and localities, you cannot pass anything in this arena. It's a federal arena, and so hands off. To us, that's an illegitimate use of preemption because if a locality wants to pass something more stringent in the area of environmental protection or food safety, it prevents them from doing so. So even if they act to protect the rights, health, safety, and welfare for people in their community, they're prevented by that preemption clause from doing so. And so you have preemption, you have corporate rights, you have this third thing called Dillon's Rule, which is this fascinating legal theory that emerged in the early 1900s from a lawyer for the railroad corporations, which were some of the biggest corporations of their day, in which this legal doctrine called Dillon's Rule, which establishes that the relationship of the municipality to the state, in other words, the relationship between your community and the state government, is one of a child to a parent. And that the parent can control absolutely and exclusively what powers the community can actually exercise in terms of lawmaking. So when a community says, well, we're going to ban big box stores from our community, one of the other challenges that comes from the big box store corporation when they sue the community is to say, you don't have the power to pass that ordinance because the state legislature has never given you that power. And therefore, under Dillon's Rule, we can sue you to overturn the ordinance. And finally, the fourth doctrine is this rights of nature concept. It's hard to get our brains around it, but in the United States today, nature is property. So if you own a 10-acre piece of land, the deed that you have for that piece of property carries with it the legal authority for you to destroy the ecosystems on that piece of property. And we always get in trouble for saying so, but there's never been an environmental movement in the United States because it's always been based on a property notion of nature and ecosystems, not on a rights-based notion of ecosystems or nature. And looking back at prior people's movements, whether it be the abolitionists or the suffragists, movements are actually about moving rights into the constitutional structure for things that were previously treated as property. So the abolitionists moved African Americans, transitioned from treatment as property to being persons under the law. The suffragists did the same, and of course, subject to the limitations. When we say full persons, of course, women don't make the same wages as men at this point, and a lot of folks would say that African Americans in our society still don't have the same rights as others in society. But the movements were aimed at actually transitioning things that were once property into being rights-bearing. We've never had an environmental movement in this country because we've never had any kind of movement based on rights for nature and ecosystems. And so, essentially, if nature is property, if you're the largest entity that has the most power to buy the most property, you have the consequent authority to destroy the most ecosystems, because you can own the most property. And so disentangling that situation is part of the work that we do. But those four legal doctrines have been very carefully put into place as a box, almost, of allowable activism. We're allowed to operate within the box, subject to those constraints, which is why we don't usually pursue lawmaking on these issues to move towards sustainability. We do things like build farmers markets and buy Priuses and change light bulbs. We do all the voluntary stuff that are very important things to do, but we rarely ever move outside the box to begin challenging those doctrines. It's our opinion as an organization that it is impossible to build sustainability while operating within that box. And in fact, the forces of unsustainability have very carefully concocted this box of activism and built these legal doctrines so that communities purposefully can't use the structure of law to actually move towards sustainability. So at some point, if we care about sustainability, and the planet's in crisis mode right now, we're headed off the cliff. Some people would say we're already partway off the cliff. Is that the situation is, unless we're going to remove those legal doctrines and build a movement that's capable of removing those legal doctrines, then we're pretty much screwed here on planet Earth. And unfortunately, it's our country that's leading the way. It's the United States that exports folks out to the international trade agreements, which in essence has exported out the Commerce Clause structure that we have in our own U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution that we have in the United States today is the 1789 relic that in essence was written to guarantee the fastest and quickest exploitation of natural resources across the country as a way of making the United States a world power. It's time to begin to build new models. It's time to build new sustainability models. It's time to build new sustainability structures of law. And we, for one, think that means probably a new constitution. And what we're seeing now with these 120 ordinances across different municipalities in the United States and these municipalities starting to join together to actually talk about codifying these models of law higher up the ladder at the state level and eventually at the federal level, we think is the beginnings of a new constitutional movement, which has its sights set on nothing less than changing the federal structure of law to liberate these communities to build sustainability. And in the meantime, liberate them from these legal doctrines that trap them in a place where they can't. And I think that's the most important work, actually, that has to be done by communities, 10,000, 100,000 communities across the United States. We see ourselves mostly as a service organization, a facilitator, so that when communities run up against these hurdles, they can come to us. The joke around our office is that we're the law firm of last resort, which is when there's nowhere else to turn, our phone lights up. And these are people who have run into that wall and want to move beyond it.
I think the reality is that we're far more of a grassroots organizing organization now than anything, because we certainly provide legal counsel to municipalities and we do help them to draft ordinances. Most recently, the city of Pittsburgh adopted one of our ordinances. They're facing natural gas drilling right inside the city of Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania. And we assisted that city council to draft an ordinance and the organizing that goes along with this, the public education, the democracy schools, the outreach, and helping people to understand how the structure of law works. Why does it prevent them from protecting their community from something as damaging as, in West Virginia, for example, mountaintop removal mining? That's legally authorized at the federal level, and corporations are allowed to go ahead and blow the tops off mountains. They're allowed to go ahead and play around with our aquifers and stick natural gas pipeline wells right through them. You know, all of these sorts of things that we think shouldn't happen, but in fact are happening. And I think what happens is in communities that we don't really have to pay attention to this kind of stuff until that threat comes right up to our doorstep. And that's why I think the Citizens United decision, you know, people haven't had to deal with corporate rights until they do. And they don't have to deal with this idea that nature is considered property under the law until they do, until they face that threat. And I think that's part of the reason, a large part of the reason why people often ask us, well, why aren't you doing this work at the state or federal level? And the answer is that we don't see that kind of change being able to be mobilized at the state or federal level right now. We see it very much beginning at the local grassroots level, community by community, person by person, and replicating that organizing across communities and regions, and then bringing those communities together to drive the kind of change these communities are seeking up to the state level, and then organizing at the state level up to the federal level. We look a lot at past people's movements, as Thomas mentioned, with the suffragists and the abolitionists, and we look a lot at them, and in fact, in the democracy schools, and take lessons from them as to how they drove huge change and changed our constitution to change illegitimate structures of law. They began at the most local level. I mean, they began with a handful of people and spread that word out person by person, community by community, and began to seek change at the local level, driving that change upward to the state and federal level. To our minds, that's the way that real movements begin necessarily. And I think the communities that we work with, they're really standing on their shoulders, taking those lessons and driving them forward.
So mirroring what the populists did, the populist movement?
Yeah, exactly.
Somewhat. I mean, the populists didn't aim for constitutional or structural change, so we tend to put them in a different category. But what the populists, the farmers of the late 1800s, did was simply amazing. They had 40,000 lecturers spread out across the United States to build this movement. They came to some of the same conclusions, except that they attempted to participate in the political process and didn't seek constitutional change, unlike the abolitionists or the suffragists. But, you know, at some point, What this work is about, the work that these communities are doing, is almost like a new civil rights movement of sorts. You know, Martin Luther King Jr., in his letter from a Birmingham jail, said things, you know, there are laws in place that have been passed properly, you know, that are statutes, but that doesn't make them right. That there are illegitimate laws and legitimate laws, and our duty is to disobey the illegitimate ones, the immoral ones, the unethical ones. That there's a higher calling, a higher law. And in our work, you know, there are laws that are legal, but they're not sustainable. And I think that's the differentiation that has to be drawn at some point, and an understanding that the communities are really the experts on what's sustainable and what's not in their own communities. And our job, I think, in many ways, is to bring those two concepts together, to actually bring the legal and sustainable together, so that something can't be legal but not sustainable. It's actually bringing them into harmony somehow. And I think that's what these communities are starting to do. The city of Pittsburgh, for example, Amari talked about, that banned natural gas extraction within the community. They came to a conclusion that natural gas extraction in the city of Pittsburgh was not sustainable. It may be legal because the state permits it, but it's not sustainable. And so the city ordinance was about bringing that harmony into existence between legality and sustainability. And it's not talked about much with the Pittsburgh ordinance, because the national, international news that went out about Pittsburgh was, hey, here's the first major municipality to ban natural gas extraction. They did, but they did something even more complex and in some ways even more logical, which is they were the first major municipality to pass a local Bill of Rights. And this local Bill of Rights was about expanding the rights of people and ecosystems and nature and communities at the local level, and then banning those activities which would violate those rights. And so the ban on natural gas extraction was really a second step. The first step was the Bill of Rights that secured new and expanded rights to people within the city of Pittsburgh, and then made a finding that natural gas extraction within the city automatically violated that Bill of Rights framework that was put into place. And then the city took the third step, which was to say, we understand that traditional, current, conventional law runs counter to all of the things that we're doing here in the city of Pittsburgh, and we're going to put protective layers in here. And one of the things they did was they stripped corporations, natural gas corporations, of constitutional rights and protections within the city of Pittsburgh. And on the preemption issue, they said any state permit that gets issued that actually violates the ordinance and the Bill of Rights that have been passed in the city is void. It's not valid within the city of Pittsburgh. So what you see is these municipalities moving forward in a very smart way, which is to say, we're going to take the best legacy, the best history of this country, which is about rights and democratic self-government, and we're going to stick that into this ordinance. It's going to be the main thing that this ordinance does, which is expand civil rights within this community and expand it into environmental, social, cultural rights, those types of things. Then ban those activities, which are not sustainable when you measure them up against those rights, because they automatically violate that rights framework. And then we're going to take on those legal doctrines that say we can't do this in the first place. So we're going to take on preemption. We're going to take on corporate rights. We're going to take on Dillon's rule. We're going to take on nature as property. We're going to take on all those those things. And just as a side note, we have 24 communities now who have passed ordinances that declare that nature is not property in their community, that nature and ecosystems actually have legally, independently enforceable rights to exist and flourish, that people in the communities can step in the shoes of a river to defend the river's rights, for example, rather than fighting through the permit and regulatory process that's imposed upon them. And so when I say this is revolutionary, I think it really is. It's about a new frame. It's about changing this frame of commerce and property that we've been involved in for 140 years now as a country, and actually shifting that so it's a sustainability frame. And the only way that happens is to force it from below, and I think that's what these communities are beginning to do in the United States.
Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you both for coming and spending time with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Again, we've just been talking with Thomas Lindsay and Maury Margill, both with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and you can find out more via their website, celdf.org.